the chapter that begins with an ominous note of pending disaster ends with an encouraging note of hope that the disaster brought by sin will not be the last word in God's creation. That hope was already on display in the wonderful promise in verse 15 of the coming Redeemer and in the name that Adam chose for his wife. He called her the mother of all living, not the mother of all dying. That hope was also evident in the clothes that Adam and Eve wore, clothes that provided evidence of blood atonement. We've been singing tonight about the blood, and let us remember that it was the Creator Himself who first shed the blood of animals to provide coats of skin for Adam and Eve. Still, with all of that, the irony was great. When the third chapter of Genesis opens, Adam and Eve are still in their innocence. They know no guilt and no shame. But when it ends, they both stand there looking very mortal. Beings made in the image of God, but clothed in the skins of dead animals. It would seem that such an irony would be sufficient to break down the proudest heart. But the Scriptures leave us with no conclusion except that Adam would require still more to bring him to the full realization of what his sin had made him. Apparently unwilling to remove from the Garden of Eden by his own choice, Adam would have to be removed from that garden by the hand of God. He had been told that he would have to eat bread in the sweat of his face until he would die. But the narrative leaves us with the reality that Adam was still not sufficiently humbled. He would have to be compelled to leave that paradise already stained by his sin. And he would have to be prevented from ever coming back, from ever having any access to the tree of life. And yet it would be this final act in this chapter that would demonstrate that God had only the best thoughts and the best intentions concerning Adam and Eve. For them, in their corrupt condition, to eat the fruit of the tree of life and to live forever in that estate of guilt and shame would be too horrible to contemplate. God would not allow it to happen. But for Adam and Eve to be able to see the tree of life while being prevented from eating of it would be a bitter blow to them, too bitter for them to bear. And so the Lord Himself, in His kindness toward His creatures, caused the tree of life to be hidden from their view by the flaming sword that turned every way to prevent any view of that tree. Adam would have to accept his way in the world that his sin had served to ruin. He must leave behind the Garden of Eden and give up all hope of ever seeing paradise again, as the result of his own actions. He must not look to himself. He must look for the Redeemer, for the promised seed of the woman. He must look for the coming of new heavens and a new earth in which will dwell righteousness again. So there is about the last part of this chapter a shining message of the gospel. That is why I say that it ends with a very hopeful note. All is not lost. But the man no longer has the ability to gain life through his own obedience. He has broken the covenant of works. And he has failed miserably in the obligations laid upon him by the Creator. But another Adam would come. As Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden to make their lives elsewhere in the world, they did so with the message of hope before them, that there would be another Adam, and that he would not fail. All had been lost at that point, but all would be regained. Their being sent out was part of God's judgment, that is true. But it was also what we may rightly call mercy amid the ruins. Some have wondered at the inclusion of what they deem an epilogue at the close of this chapter. Some have wondered why the narrative does not jump directly from verse 21 to the opening statement of the next chapter. Certainly, the story would seem to flow nicely in that way. But the Holy Spirit wanted us to know something. He wanted us to know that sin is truly horrible, and that its fountain in the pride of the depraved heart still gushes forth its vileness, even after that vileness has been discovered and condemned. It still gushes forth its vileness, even in the face of abject humiliation. The pride that led Adam and Eve to rebel against their Creator, and then that led them to make aprons out of fig leaves, was the pride that made them reluctant to leave the Garden of Eden. They did not believe that what they had done while it was bad was so horrible. They were hopeful of some other way to avoid having to face the sobering consequences in the world cursed as a result of their sin. Consequences of their rebellion. But it was for the good of Adam and Eve that God expelled them from the garden and ensured that they would never get back into it. Judgment, while it is painful, is the means by which our pride is humbled. And we are made to live in total subjection to the word and will of the Creator. It was an awful thing that they had to be sent out, but it was the only way they could remember their true relationship to God. These verses at the end of Genesis 3 set before us three powerful ideas that make us see the ruins brought by sin and the mercy of God in the midst of them. Let us look first of all at verse 22, where we see sin's horrible prospect. Now, there has been a lot of discussion on the meaning of various aspects of verse 22. one of the aspects of the verse that has elicited discussion is the statement, the man is become as one of us. Some have seen here an argument for the doctrine of the Trinity. Certainly there would seem to be at least a hint of that doctrine when the Lord refers to himself as us, refers to himself in the plural. Calvin was not of the mind that that was a sufficient reference to establish that doctrine. But I think certainly there is at least a hint of it. There is at least a plurality of persons being designated there in the Godhead. But the real question is, what does it mean when God said the man has become as one of us? Now, let us review the background here. Remember the devil's temptation, the serpent's temptation was, God knows in the day you eat thereof, you will become as gods, knowing good and evil. That was the prospect that he held out before Eve. But we know that what the devil said to them is not what the reality was. We know that the knowledge that Adam and Eve gained of good and evil was not the knowledge the devil promised them they would gain, not the knowledge that God has of those things, but a completely opposite knowledge. They gained the knowledge of evil by experience, and they came to know good only as a theory. So what does it mean when God said the man has become as one of us? Well, Calvin saw it as a use of irony. And this is the way he explained it. The force of the expression is that the man, and I'm quoting from Calvin now, in whom recently the glory of the divine image was shining, should be hidden under fetid skins, to cover his own disgrace, and that there should be more comeliness in a dead animal than in a living man. So the idea was, this man was made in our image. He was made in the image of us. He was made as a reflection of us. And now look at this man. Now that this argument has good effect is seen in the reminder that this situation arose from Adam's ambition. It arose from his desire to know what God knows, to know good and evil as God knew it. He had, as Lucifer, tried to improve the estate in which God had created him. He was not content with the estate in which God created him, and he could only seek to improve that estate by an open rebellion against the Creator's explicit command, do not eat of that tree. Here then is the awful reality that resulted. Here is this wreck of a being, clothed in the skins of dead animals, unable any longer to inhabit the paradise of God. God's comment is on the horrible irony that the very thing that Adam sought in his rebellion was the thing that he lost by his rebellion. He was already made in the image of God. He could not improve upon that image. But he accepted the idea that he could. He had gained nothing. And can you imagine the scene here at the end of chapter 3? Here's Adam, here's his wife. They're looking on each other, facing the shock of this situation. Here they are standing there, perhaps still able to smell the odor of the animals that had been slain to cover their sin. And they had to reflect on the unhappiness into which they had brought themselves. And that this was all a result of their own pride. But there was a more serious scenario to consider, as we see in this verse. And here's the other part of the verse that has occasioned discussion. Why does the verse end the way it does? The verse ends with God laying out a situation that must be considered truly horrible in every respect. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever, what? The statement is left hanging. There is a condition. In logic, the if clause is called the condition. The then clause is called the conclusion. The if clause is there, lest he should do this, lest he should take and eat of the tree and live forever. What? The conclusion is too horrible to put into words. God could not even express it. It was that horrible. What if Adam, in his condition of total depravity, his condition of rebellion, his condition of pride, what if Adam should take of the fruit of the tree of life and eat it and live forever in that condition? What then? The conclusion is not even expressed. How terrible that would be. There are people, and their whole goal in life is to see how long they can live. And you read stories, I read one not too long ago, the prediction that by the middle or the latter part of this 21st century, the average lifespan is going to be 120 years. Well, I don't know. Maybe it will be. Who can tell? But I want to tell you, if that's true, and if people are still able to function past 100 years of age in the way in which they function now, that will be a horrible prospect for the world. People are fond of speaking without any justification at all of hell on earth. Well, here is what hell on earth would be like. If sinners could live forever in the midst of their depravity, that would be hell on earth. It is a mercy that they do not live forever. It was a mercy that Adam and Eve would not be allowed to live forever. They had been promised more than paradise by the devil, but they had been reduced to fur-clad mortal beings. They must not be continued. They must not be allowed to continue living forever. Here is the horrible prospect of sin. And there was only one remedy that God put down. And that is the second thing we find in the words of verse 23, Adam's fitting humiliation. The man whose body was so carefully crafted by God. You think of the connection of the Creator to Adam. He took the dust of the ground, he formed that dust into a human body, and then breathed into that body the breath of life. That body that was so carefully crafted, that man whose breath was the result of God's own breath, was sent away from the garden. There was a great symbol of the broken fellowship between the Creator and Adam. He was sent away from the garden, and he was sent away so that he would work. So that he would work. Notice that? The Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence he was taken, so that he would work. Now, there's a lot of talk about what they call the Puritan work ethic, and there is such a thing, and Protestants historically have believed in being industrious, being entrepreneurial, and working hard, and so on. But let's be honest this evening. At the end of the day, the fact that we must work is a reminder to us every day that we are depraved. What is it that sinners today seek to get out of? Work! Or they're looking for ways that if they have to work, it won't be too hard on them physically or emotionally or in any other way. Adam was sent forth to work. And as he worked, he would have to contemplate the very ground from which his body had been made. He would labor every day, and would see, as he did, the destiny to which his flesh would ultimately come. There he was, tilling the ground, plowing up the ground, weeding the ground, and every weed he would pull would be a reminder to him of the curse that God had placed upon the world as a result of sin. There he would be, looking at the ground, looking at the dirt, and remembering the words, "You're going to go back to that, Adam. You were taken out of that dirt, and you're going to go back to it." Sin had left Adam with nothing but back breaking labor and soul stultifying misery. He was sent forth to till the ground. And what had he been told? In verse 19 of this chapter, you're going to do so in the sweat of your face. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be arduous. And you know what he would find? As he was doing this labor, he would find his vast mental powers beginning to fail. If all he was going to do would be to till the ground, wouldn't be too long before a lot of the use for the mental powers that he had when he was created would begin to go away. He would become accustomed to laboring from dawn to dusk to bring forth crops from the earth. Yes, it was judgment. It was judgment. But was it not a fitting judgment? Did not Adam need the constant reminders that his own pride had brought him to such a condition? Did he not need the constant reminders that God had not taken him away from the world? That in removing him from the Garden of Eden, God had still left him living in the world. He was sent out. Yes. And that was a humiliation. But it was a fitting humiliation. Because the sending out was a reminder to Adam that the Creator had not forsaken him. That the Creator continued to love him. This is, to me, one of the greatest aspects of the last part of this chapter. God showing his care for the creatures who had rebelled against him. And every day, when you work, there is a lesson for you. This is God's care for you. It's a reminder that God has taken thought for your own soul. You see, Adam was left in the world to live for more than 9 centuries. 930 years Adam lived from the day that he was created. And as he lived through those centuries, we read in the scriptures he had sons and daughters, and in the face of every one of them, he could see the stamp of his own rebellion, his own depravity. He could see it in his grandchildren. He could see it in his great-grandchildren, in his great-great-grandchildren. However many generations he saw, probably numerous generations, he could see it in them all. But he could also reflect on the reality of hope, because the very fact that children were being born, and that some of these children were in the people of God for whom Christ had undertaken to be the Redeemer, that very fact left him with hope. He was humbled. It was humbling for him. But it was a humiliation that made him see himself in the proper light. The Lord sent him forth to till the ground. And against this backdrop of his humiliation, there is one other thing for us to consider, and that is in verse 24, God's tender compassion. Now, it seems a strange thing to speak of tender compassion when we come to the words of verse 24. For what do we read there? He drove out the man. That doesn't sound like a tender compassion. He placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims, guards, and a flaming sword. My, this is not the language of compassion. But in driving out the man, the idea is that he sent him forth, and the implication of the language in verse 24 is that Adam was still not willing to go. So that God had to drive him out, literally to cast him out. And in doing that, and in placing cherubims at the entrance to Eden, and in removing from Adam any possibility that he would ever see the tree of life, let alone touch it or eat from it, God was keeping Adam from the constant reminder of his own failure. Suppose God had left Adam where he could see the tree of life and yet prevented him having access to it. What would Adam be confronted with every day? I could have had access to that except for my failures. He would have spent his whole life talking about his failures. But instead, God cast him out from there and set up this barricade so he would never see that again. And it's interesting that the cherubims were set up there, for they were to be associated in Scripture not only with judgment, but with mercy. And it would be very significant in that connection that the images of the cherubims would be looking down on the mercy seat on the Ark of the Covenant. Let us turn to that portion in Exodus chapter 25. Exodus chapter 25. And let us look at verse 20. And the cherubims shall stretch forth their wings on high, covering the mercy seat with their wings, and their faces shall look one to another. Toward the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubims be. And thou shalt put the mercy seat above upon the ark, and in the ark thou shalt put the testimony that I shall give thee. And there I will meet with thee, and I will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubims which are upon the ark of the testimony, of all things which I will give thee in commandment unto the children of Israel. And that image continued very vividly in the minds of the people of God for many centuries. Hezekiah, in praying to the Lord, spoke of him as the one who dwells between the cherubims. The mercy seat, that was that slab of pure gold that was on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And as we read in verse 21, inside the Ark was the testimony. What was the testimony? The tables of the law. They were placed inside the Ark. The tables written with the finger of God. Yes, even after Moses broke the first tables, in a fit of anger, when he saw the fornication of the people, God produced another set, because you could not destroy those words. So the tables of the law were inside the ark, and as God looked upon the tables of the law, what did he see? He saw that the people had broken that law again and again. But the mercy seat that covered those tables of the law was literally the propitiatory place. It was the meeting place between God and the people, between God and sinners. And how did that work? The high priest, once a year, on the Day of Atonement, came into that place and sprinkled blood on that mercy seat. And that sprinkling of that blood upon that mercy seat was the sign of atonement. And God looked at the blood, which was the evidence of the atonement, and he said, "My wrath is satisfied. The breaking of the law is covered." The cherubims were to be associated then with the atonement. What a wonderful thought this is. That as Adam and Eve were being driven out from the garden, they could see the cherubims that God posted there, and they could be reminded that the God who sent them forth in judgment was also the God who was providing for their redemption in mercy. What of the flaming sword? Again, there have been many who have sought to turn this into some sort of an allegory. What does this mean? But I think it's best just to take it as it is. A flaming sword. I don't know how to explain it to you. But a flaming sword. The God who created all the universe is certainly able to deal in a supernatural fashion here. A sword that turned every way. A sword then that was the same, no matter what your vantage point would be. It turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. In other words, to prevent Adam or Eve or any of their descendants from ever approaching that place again. They had been close to immortality, but through pride, they had lost it. And so they were cast out of the garden. They went out from Eden. And as we will see when we come to the next chapter, they began to conduct their lives in this world as befits those who are sinners. They had to deal with all of the heartache, all of the devastation that sin brings. And they had, as sinners, to depend on the mercy of God for everything they had, for everything they needed. How were they going to get through each day? By the mercy of God. That's why I speak of mercy amid the ruins. For they could not escape the reality of what had happened. But they had to live. And they had to live for a long time. How did they do it? How did Adam go out to till the ground every day? Can you think of doing that for over 900 years? How did he do it? By the mercy of God. They had to look every day with the eye of faith to the coming of the promised Redeemer. That's how they got through every day. But wait, this sounds familiar. Isn't that how sinners must get through every day now? How do you get through every day? You do what they did. You depend on the mercy of God. You look even upon the chastisement of God as a token of mercy and kindness to you. You depend on that mercy. And you look to the Redeemer. Now for us, the Redeemer has already come. We're not looking for a Redeemer to come except for Him to come the second time to bring the consummation of that redemption. But we're looking to the Redeemer. And by faith in the Redeemer, we rest on the provision that He has made for us. So even in the ruins of the sins of our own lives, we encounter mercy. And that's why I say there is hope. Hope in the midst of the heartache. Hope in the midst of loss. Hope in the midst of tribulation. God has not forsaken His people. Adam and Eve were among His people. God would not let them go their own way. He humbled their pride and sent them forth to prove His mercy every day of their lives in this world. And that is what God is doing for us today. In various ways, He humbles our pride, for we must confess the fountain of that vileness still gushes forth. He humbles our pride, sends us forth to live, and we must live every day as those who depend entirely upon the mercy of God. And at the end of it all, that brings us again to the cross. When we sang the way of the cross leads home, how do we go on in this world from day to day? We go on in the blood-sprinkled way, in the path that the Savior trod. That is the way that leads us through each day, and that leads us ultimately to the end, to the home of the redeemed. Adam and Eve are there now. They got there. It took them a long time of living in this world, but they got there. And so will the Lord's people today reach that place. There is mercy amid the ruins. Adam and Eve proved it. And so will we.